Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Chris Maynard, whose iconic book about ghosts cast titillating tremors up and down the spines of a generation of schoolchildren, including you, Rob.
Indeed. Then we'll be getting out of the studio and into the bar as we get a special Christmas cocktail-making workshop from one of London's best bartenders.
And we'll be exploring psychedelic magic and its connections to the pre-Christian roots of Christmas. Oh yes, you did hear that right.
That is all coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be giving us a good hard Christmas week look ahead, and we'll enjoy some fine music too. That's all coming up right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Rob, here we are.
Wow. Hardly time to draw breath this week, Org.
Tell me about it.
It's been quite a turbo week.
Lots on the cards, lots of programming to get done, lots of books for you, magazines, newspapers, an orgy of media.
Lots of rapping as well.
Lots of rapping.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah, Christmas rapping.
What's your sort of tactic for rapping? Do you get all the sellotape up and you roll it and you kind of stick it all along the table on which you're wrapping the presents?
I do.
Are you methodical, or do you kind of get into a panic with each separate section of the parcel that needs to be wrapped?
I do that. I put all of the bits of tape on the table, but then they fold in on themselves,
yeah.
They get stuck together. Also, they accumulate...
They take some of the paint and veneer off the table.
Often. Yeah. They accumulate my fingerprints in a way that makes me feel somehow monitored,
yeah.
Which I don't like.
You feel somehow monitored.
Somehow monitored.
It also makes the gift look that much more scruffy.
Are you looking forward to it? That's the big question.
I really am. I'm looking forward to the break. I like the music. I like the tree. I like the food. I like everyone getting together. It's really good vibes.
And
I could do with an extra week, but couldn't we all?
We certainly could. What's your meat of choice on the day?
Well, I'll be going down to visit my parents. It's a family thing down in Sussex for me. My mum, who's hated turkey for her whole life, decided to do it last year, has realised that actually it's quite nice.
Okay, a turk epiphany.
So I think small turkeys are the moist turkeys. It's I'm sure she probably knew its first name when it was alive. It's that sort of...
An intimate turkey knowledge.
An organic... What's your meat of choice?
I think turkey too.
Yeah?
There's been talk of beef Wellington, which I do like.
Yeah.
But not much leftovers with that, is there?
No. You kind of want... You want something. You want a bit of red meat, maybe,
yeah.
On Boxing Day.
Okay. I think so.
I like it. Anything on croute, I'm a fan of, though.
Okay.
Yeah?
Salmon,
beef welly, sticky toff. Lay it on thick. Talking of laying it on thick... I think I can hear him tapping on the glass. It's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, ready for his news look ahead. There was something in the air that night. The
stars were bright, Fernando. Fernando, welcome to the Monocle Weekly once more for what? I think the last news look ahead of 2019, and indeed of the decade.
Still a very busy one, I have to say. The war doesn't stop.
No, indeed.
It's true.
Guys, I know, you know I love elections, and you would say... The last weekend of the year, there's no elections. There is.
Are there? Who's mad enough to have an election?
How have you not had election fatigue after all these bloody elections this year?
I still get excited and disappointed after I see the result, because it's been a while since I saw a result that actually I really liked.
Mm.
But nevertheless, today... Actually, Croatia is voting for a new president. The main contender here is the current one, Kolinda Grabar.
Father Christmas. my feeling is he's going to win.
Well, she's quite popular, actually, among Croatians. I mean, I don't think she's going to get the share of votes she got the first time. She's the first female leader of Croatia. And she's a self-declared modern conservative.
Okay.
But I've been reading a little bit about her. I think she's... Just a conservative.
Okay. Old's got strong feelings on that.
Exactly. Other candidates, I thought it was quite interesting. There's a guy called Miroslav Šora. He's a folk musician. So he plays kind of some sort of, it's Croatian pop, but
okay.
I mean, there's some folk elements into it. I mean, he's apparently a serious contender.
Is this another of these populists? Another of these upstart populists? Popular entertainers come to...
Well, folk music's the music of protest, isn't it?
It's true,
normally, yeah. So he might well be, you know...
Listen, I don't know much about him, but he had a very gentle face. it's all part of my first story, okay? But just so you know, I need to tell this to listeners. Yeah. This week also, there will be parliamentary elections in Uzbekistan and municipal elections in Azerbaijan.
Wow.
So, you know, the world keeps on going.
Right. Are they used to voting in the snow? That's the question. What's the turnout going to be like there?
Great, exactly. Great name for a short story, voting in the snow.
Exactly. Well, another happier story. It's happening today as well. It's the El Gordo Lottery in Madrid.
Oh, yeah, the big one.
And I have to say, I've been thinking a lot about lottery recently. I never actually went to a place and bought like a lottery ticket. I think I might do that for the first time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know why? Because I would love to buy, you know, a tropical modernist house on the coast of Brazil. What would you guys get with your lottery ticket?
If I won the lottery?
Yeah, if you won the lottery.
I think I'd buy myself out of bondage, probably.
Okay. Yeah. Didn't know you were into that.
Didn't mean it like that.
Yeah. What would you do?
I think I'd immediately send myself on a year-long holiday to drive around the continent of America, north and south. I'd definitely come and visit you on the beautiful coast in your lovely house.
What's our last stop for the news look ahead, Pat?
Sorry, that's a bit obvious, but it's Wednesday, it's going to be Christmas. And I was a bit jealous when you guys are talking about which meat are you going to eat, because I know which meat I'll be eating. Beef.
Okay.
I mean, I have to be honest, my family is not super traditional when it comes to Christmas. I remember when I was a kid, I have to say, Mom, we need a Christmas tree. So she told me, I only put the Christmas tree for you, Fernando. So yeah, it's going
to
be...
You going back to Brazil for Christmas?
Yes, absolutely. Nice. So it's going to be beef.
Tree?
I hope she would put a tree this year.
What else about Christmas is it? Because I'm sure you're a fan of the full nativity, Faye.
Absolutely. I love a good nativity. I like the songs as well. Yeah. And that's something the UK... you know, teach me about, because I have to be honest, in Brazil we have one or two songs that some of the radios play, but we don't have this tradition of start playing Christmas songs like late November. We usually play just on the day and they're quite low key, so quite like, maybe I should introduce this to my fellow
Brazilians.
I
can feel like you're going to turn up to the Pacheco residence on Christmas Eve armed with Christmas carols, possibly even a tree, an emergency tree under your
arm. Some carnival bossa nova.
Yeah, God, I wouldn't mind an invitation, would you?
Certainly not, especially if it were to take place in that beautiful mid-century modernist house perched on the coastal road between Rio and what's just south of it, Guarujá.
Exactly, I would love that.
Yes, yeah, please. Fernando, thank you so much for joining us. Have a lovely Christmas back home in Brazil. Send our fond regards to the clan. And we'll see you in 2020. You at home are listening to the Monocle Weekly. In just a moment, we'll be hearing from Chris Maynard, whose efforts in children's publishing thrilled a generation. Sure, this is the time of year for cosy togetherness and dressing the tree, but it's also when the nights draw in the tightest and darkest and thoughts turn to the supernatural. Whose face is that at the window peering in as we wrap our presents? Why did that Advent candle gutter and go out?
Well, a children's book long out of print but recently brought back thanks to an online campaign might be able to explain all. The Usborne World of the Unknowns, all about ghosts, was a fixture in British school libraries and newsagents' bookshelves during the 1970s and 1980s, and I, as a child, was obsessed with its tinder-dry depictions of spooky happenings. The series was written and edited by Chris Maynard, who joined me earlier in the studio. Chris, I think I'm sort of reliving a sort of schoolboy fantasy sitting in a radio studio with you, and a shiver is running down my spine at the very presence in the room and the re-presence of the Usborne's World of the Unknown, the ghost version of the Usborne Book of the Unknown. It's lovely to meet you. Mm-hmm. What was the genesis of this book back in the day? Because this is part of a strain of publishing. There was a UFOs one, a monsters one. How did it kick off?
Well, the book itself fits into a wider slot. There was a boom in the 70s in UK publishing, in children's publishing particularly, but it spread right across all genres at the time. But basically, kids coming out of universities met kids coming out of art colleges, and we started producing complicated layouts. The technology was really simple. We sat there with scalpels and rulers and large sheets of layout paper, and everything had to be prepared for camera, but it took forever to get all of this into place. And we were able to do it better than almost anywhere else in the world, which meant that suddenly we could sit down, knock these books out over a week or two or month, whatever, however long it took, The salesman would go away to Frankfurt or Bologna and come back with million-pound orders, and this whole cycle would continue like that. Effectively, we just went through subject by subject by subject, saying, is there something interesting that we could say here, do about, you know, with this? And at some point, World of the Unknown became, it's one of those bathtub moments for the publisher, yeah. Probably. He was just sat there and said, well, if we can do dinosaurs and we can do science books and we can do almost any biology, why can't we do World of the Unknown?
Well, the great skills that that you guys put together or you guys possessed and put into this particular series, the Usborne World of the Unknown series, obviously has it's sent shivers down the spine of children, British children, especially, I suppose, from the 1970s through the 1980s, maybe the 1990s. This book might well have been passed down as well. I had this probably in a school library originally, and then I probably badgered my mum to buy me a copy of it. So this would have kind of been kicking around, and it got to the point where I was basically unable to kind of, you know, go to the loo or go upstairs to bed on my own. When you were putting this together, I'm sure I know the answer to this, did this seem like a bit of fun? Or did you realise you were kind of onto something that would later be kind of reprinted, crowdfunded, and kind of fresh life be brought into it?
We had actually no idea whatsoever. We were competitive with each other, obviously, within the company. So we wanted to knock out the best book possible. We were aware of the other competition, and that the other competition was up and down Covent Garden and in and out of Soho. And it was a very small world. I don't know, 20 companies were out there. So we knew what everybody else was doing. But we had no way of knowing what happened to the books once we pushed them into the distribution chain. And other than bumping into the books in bookshops occasionally, we didn't really get what happened. The reviews, such as they were, would be Christmas reviews. So 20 books would be reviewed simultaneously, and a sentence or two would refer to the Book of Ghosts. But no one had a sense that it was special in any way.
I want to get into the book itself because it is very special. And as you know from the sort of online, the media campaign online that crowdfunded it to bring it back to existence in its present form, Chris. Mm. I want to look at a few spreads with you, a few pages. You're looking at Pluckley there. You've chosen Pluckley, England's most haunted village.
Right.
This terrified me because it looked a little bit like where I grew up. Or you could imagine the sort of the Queen Anne-ish farmhouse, the woods, the haunted church, all these sorts of places. Yep. This was obviously in a pre-internet age. How did you hit upon Pluckley as one of the world's most haunted places?
My research mainly took me to libraries, newspaper cuttings, and the...
You're up in Colindale at the old newspaper.
Well, that's right, yeah.
Library, yeah.
Exactly. Just looking for stories everywhere. And the Society for Psychical Research had a terrific library of myths and legends. And the same, through my reading, the same stories kept coming up again and again. And what bubbled to the top, remember, the research that we did at the time would have produced 3 or 4 copies of this book. It was a great stack of things. And we culled and culled until we had what we thought were the best examples.
Yeah.
So the haunted village kept coming up. There were haunted villages up, down, and sideways.
And it's very gothic conceit, the kind of haunted village where everything happens in this one little place.
It does. It does. It's as though, I don't know, one day in 1842, you know, 20 villages in England decided to become haunted.
Exactly. Exactly. I suppose there was plague, there was war, there was plenty of things that could lead into these things.
But probably a lot of family dysfunction behind all of this.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, a bit of that as well.
So what was nice about, I'm culling things out of libraries for the most part, and I'm, you know, extracting as much information as I can. And what was nice about Pluckley is this was the one moment where we actually did some original research by ourselves. And I went out with the art director and we spent a day wandering around the village. The village looked like a commuter village. It was a bit, you know, fringes of London or, you know, inside Kent, possibly not computer. It was well put together. It was boring beyond belief, and there was absolutely no one there. So we wandered around with our maps and our notebooks and our camera, taking the most boring thing I've ever seen in my life.
And these are the photographs that ended
and
up in the
And these are the photos that ended in the book. And what I'm so... first of all...
They're imbued with terror for me.
Well, perfect.
It's somehow.
It tells you the terror of the suburbs.
Yeah, there is something. We're not in Betjeman's Metroland. We're somewhere more terrifying.
We're actually... actually, it turns out, over the years, I've discovered that Kent is actually a rather violent place, and there are all kinds of mayhem that happens in that part of it, which should have a ghostly outcome, ultimately, with the murders and so on. But no, what was nice is we bumped into one or two people who assumed automatically we were estate agents. And we were so terrified of being found out, we just nodded.
Yeah, right. He just shifted off and made it up.
What do you reckon that house goes for?
But there is something. There's something about people familiar with this book will hopefully be flicking through it at least mentally as we have this conversation, Chris, because there is something about the tone of the book. And the photography, as I say, you and a photographer obviously went out and just put this together. It's got a very kind of dry, not dry tone, but it's got a scientific tone rather than a sort of a folkloric tone.
Well, you've spotted it. The tone is actually deadpan. And if we had a type...
When I say dry...
No, deadpan.
Listeners, Chris gave me an evil eye there. Not a ghostly one, just a disappointed one. But you know what I mean? You obviously chose this style.
We deliberately set out, I don't know... Somewhere, I must have done an anthropology course in university somewhere, so I was vaguely aware of 19th century anthropologists taking folklore seriously and just, you know, transcribing this stuff. So we were intergalactic anthropologists. We were here on Earth just simply to record, and whatever it is that people told us, we thought was interesting because people are interesting. And on that basis, we sort of put the book together. I personally am a bit nerdish, so I desperately managed to get a few charts and graphs in here.
Oh yes, well, also in true Osborne style. This was very much house style.
There was a house thing, and the joy of it really was that I had the artists and the designers working with me on this stuff. So no matter how loopy my ideas at the time, they were able to express them graphically. Yeah. And this is what I mean about being able to. What happened with the art colleges? They could find a language for all of this. And what's really nice is, but our basically pedestrian photos alongside deadpan text, the whole mixture you get is something totally terrifying and spooky, which I love the fact that you've provided, you as the reader, provided that extra element.
Blanks, right?
And you filled it in and you poured your own, which is exactly what you want them to do. You want the kids to engage with it on that way. We had, of course, no idea of it. The one thing used to, at the back of our minds, it was an issue.
Haunt you?
No, haunt me. Absolutely, yeah. We were aware that boys stopped reading in primary school, that there was a cliff. So there's a cliff edge that boys went off. And we never knew how to address this, but there was a hunch somehow that if we could take thingness, objects and stuff, and explain them well and illustrate them well and do exactly what we've done here, we could reach out and cross that divide or that barrier and keep them hooked on reading.
We've looked at Pluckley. People will also be very familiar with one of the spreads, which is the haunted house. Right. We've got a classic kind of Victorian mansion shot at night, obviously, with bats and a crescent moon. This was a sort of trope of Osborne books, was the cutaway. Mm-hmm. And you've done this with an entire house. Mm-hmm. There are ghostly fingers playing a piano, a candelabra swaying in the breeze, books falling off a shelf in the attic, muddy footsteps going up the stairs, all these sorts of things. Just saying it now, just looking at these pictures, they're absolutely incredible. You must have had quite a lot of fun putting this together. Were you just kind of thinking, well, what are the things you'd find in a haunted house?
I made a chart at some point of all the... Being a bit nerdish, I had something approaching a spreadsheet, but before spreadsheets were invented, which had haunted houses by name and what they all had. And we realized they were...
Oh, man, I hope you've got some of this material to hand, not to hand, but somewhere in your own attic, with or without the falling books.
Well, the thing about it is we knew about... Borley Rectory was around at the time. There was still some family, some of the original family was there. And in my research, I picked up that there was a court case or there was a potential of something litigious taking place around the stories or around the ownership of it. And we walked away from it deliberately. So we didn't actually touch Borley Rectory, but we took the Borley Rectory idea and then mapped it across with all of these little cutaways. I guess I have to say this after all these years, I think the only thing we missed out on was ghostly sex. which wasn't really that appropriate for you as a 10-year-old. I'm sure you could put that on
I'd
hold
have blushed.
For a bit. You would have blushed mightily. Exactly. Well, come back 10 years later and we'll do one for you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The next generation, of Usbournes. Something about the constant present tense in this haunted house. A ghostly, yeah. This is just figure one. A ghostly figure glides from room to room, passing straight through solid walls. Yeah. There's something about that present, that constant present, which I've always remember I found particularly frightening, like it could be happening. It was always seemed to be happening at my grandma's house, this ghoster, which is rather large.
And it was meant to give you a reference point from which you could explain the creaks and bangs in your own house and the floorboards doing what they do and things ticking away at nighttime and slow drips and so forth. So all of those things that the senses deliver to you and which are beyond, you know, beyond an instant recognition for what they are, were things that, yeah, we decided that this was a living thing and it was meant to allow you to take this information and travel around with it, being aware that there were ghostly things, that the inexplicable and so on. It was something, I think we slipped into it and it just worked beautifully.
You've got there's a spread on ghost hunting. You went off to Pluckley with one of your co-conspirators in this book, Chris. Yeah. I don't know whether the ghost hunting equipment that you used was the professional ghost hunting equipment on the right hand page or the amateurish ghost hunting equipment that certainly me and Henry Batten used to wander around the highways and byways of Surrey, Sussex and Hampshire looking for ghosts. Yeah. So particularly the notepad set out with place, date, time, what happened and witnessed by, which is all important.
Absolutely.
You must have had quite a lot of fun in this case with this ghost hunting equipment spread, sort of prying straight into the fears and hopes of potential ghost spotting children.
It was certainly designed with a view that they themselves could do exactly what we had done and wander around their house and start measuring things and sort of looking for and putting bits of thread to see if doors had opened or closed magically in the night and so on.
Yeah.
So that was very much it was something that could be emulated, except for the fact that the professional stuff was not that far removed. Mm. I've since encountered people into Hauntology, who now run ghost hunting weekends, and it's all high-tech digital stuff, measuring, I don't know, emanations in the air and oxygen levels and heartbeats.
Not quite as fun, though, is it?
No, it just sits there and blinks in the corner, and absolutely everybody just sits and stares at it for a while and then falls asleep.
and as we said, sort of Usbournes was a publisher that was all about explaining things.
Yeah.
And yet this World of the Unknown series was sort of, it had to kind of go halfway, presumably. It had to keep a lot of that mystery alive for people, to keep young readers reading and wondering, but also explain some of it. So where did you pitch your sort of editorial judgment on that?
I think it was factual. With the fact that there was a copious literature of ghosts and ghost mythology and so on, we wanted to just keep it alive as much as possible and allow for the fact that all of this was stuff that people report on and that it was a tradition. Your parents, your grandparents certainly could have told you ghost stories that would have been things that would have been handed around, local families and so on. So we wanted to just carry on with that, but use the techniques that we were using for the dinosaurs, the animals, the asteroids and so on. So we used very similar approach and we just treated it in that very gentle, quiet, continuous present.
And just finally, I mean, there are so many examples of ghosts from sort of Roman times, ghosts of animals, ghosts from sort of Native American wars and all the rest of it. What spooked you the most putting together the book those years ago?
Well, we were delighted to find examples of ghost stories from Roman times. I mean, it was lovely. The one thing we never had room to touch on was the notion that the ghosts of tomorrow are with us at the moment. And I wanted to explore that. And it was a bit difficult to find a way of getting it around. But I wanted to talk about traffic accidents as a source of ghosts. And I wanted to talk about, I don't know what, self-harming or mutilation at work or all kinds of airplane crashes and so on. All the things that you would imagine that would generate 200 years from now, the ghosts that people will be talking about, and that the equivalent of Borley Rectory, the haunted mansion, would become the haunted office.
Thank you to Chris, and All About Ghosts is available now, a perfect nostalgia hit, or even better, to spook a new generation of infants. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. It's Christmas in 3 days or something like that, which is exciting, but also brings lots of pressures, the blame for which can really be laid at the foot of late capitalism. Presents, consumption, it's a disgrace, Rob.
I couldn't disagree more, Borg. But it's also the way we do things for better or worse. So here at the Monocle Weekly, we thought we'd bring you a little tutorial that should hopefully make entertaining that little less onerous.
Christmas is a feast, but it's booze that really lubricates the day. So Monocle's own Tom Edwards and I put ourselves through a special cocktail-making workshop just for you. Eleonora Biasson of London's Scarf Bar dropped by with a couple of specially designed drinky recipes up her sleeve. Take note, these drinks may just save your bacon if and when you burn the turkey.
We're gonna do like a mulled wine. So what we're gonna do is we're gonna heat now through the kettle our cordial with spices. So it's very easy to make. So you can make it with your friends. You can make it with whatever you have at home. We started with our base of cranberry juice because we wanted to make it versatile. As obviously on Christmas Day, you will have your niece, your children, if you have children, your friends, with children, everywhere. There would be kids around. And for sure, they would like to try what the parents are having. Let's go for a versatile cordial as a base. For children, we're gonna add apple juice. For adults, we're gonna add some alcohol, obviously. In this case, all the preparation is very easy. We take our cranberry juice, we heat it up. Slightly before they start to boil, we're gonna put our spices like cloves, cinnamon, anise, and ginger, which are obviously our base, our iconic spices of Christmas. And then we will go with some bay leaves, rosemary, everything together, a full orange, just cut it in half, squeeze it inside.
It's like a homemade mull, isn't it?
Exactly.
Without going and buying a packet in the shop.
Exactly. Also because all those ingredients you can always find it in your fridge and somehow something that is very healthy and is gonna give like aromatic flavors to your mulled wine. Then we're gonna add all the other iconic spices, cinnamon and anista, bay leaf, etc. And some also peels of lemon. So just like to give a bit of freshness. After that, we let it boil everything for like roughly 10 minutes. The measure of the spice that you want to put is also up to you. I mean, it depends how much spice you like. If you like more cinnamon or if you like more anista, then obviously it depends on you. Then at the end, we will strain everything through like a fine strainer. The best way will be also by a linen, so we can get rid of all the sediments. It will be completely clear, so no one will be bothered by like some seeds or anything else. Then we will add some sugar. Obviously, it will be very bittery and herby. So we will add 150 grams of sugar for every liter of cranberry juice that we used at the beginning. So if we had 2 liters of cranberry juice and all the rest of the spices, we will add 300 grams of sugar. That one is gonna be our base, which now is hot. And so we're going to pour our ingredients. So having the cordial, which is hot, and the ingredients, which are cold, we're gonna balance the temperature, and it will be ready to drink. I'm gonna let you pour our ingredients in a nice teapot. So then we will pour our cordial inside and we're gonna balance all the temperature. We will have like 25 ml of gin. You can choose the gin that you prefer, your favorite gin, or anything that you find in your next door supermarket. So it's 25 per person. We will do like 2 portions, so you can go for 50 ml. Generosity is never a bad thing, so pour. It's full jigger. Pour as much as you can, as much as you want, obviously.
Classic, under pouring it.
You see, because he likes it to do the free pouring, you know? He learned how to do it now.
I need to watch out for the younger members of the team here, so.
For the barbecues.
This is what happens. You never want to go for dinner around his house. You suddenly find yourself drinking.
No invites coming your way. What are we adding next?
So next we add in a Camenson, which is the British aperitif that I believe everyone knows as well. So we will pour like same amount. All the ingredients, they will have the same ratio, just to have it balanced. Let's go. Until the top, amazing. Let's put it in. Exactly, that's what I like, pre-pouring. We said it's a mulled wine, so what we're missing is wine, obviously. So far we're just using a substitute, which is cranberry juice, cranberry cordial, but we're missing a wine. So for alcoholic version, we would put same amount, so 25 per person. In this case, we put 50, so full jigger, and obviously go for a touch more.
We have a Malbec here. Is this particularly well suited, or?
Absolutely. Well, that's a very generous part, but fair enough. We like that.
Probably more, slipped a bit.
Probably
there,
more like an even 100, I would say.
Yeah, but doesn't matter. It's a mulled wine, right? We need to warm up this evening, this Christmas evening. So
how scientific is this? Because if we go a little over on one or over another to a taste, is that actually part of the magic? Or, well, should you try and stick to the...
You should try to stick on the recipe, you know? So if you have a recipe which is balanced, there is a reason behind why you have a measure. But honestly, for this type of drinks, especially when you are making it at home, it's also up to you. If you prefer one type of spice, or if you prefer more wine taste rather than a gin taste, obviously gin will give you body. It's usually like 40 ABV. Wine is always less. But if you like the wine, the tannin of the wine, just go for it. You know, then it's up to you also, because now we're doing like few portions. When you are home, definitely you will do like a bigger portion for all your friends and family. You will balance it. You will taste. It's very important for everything that you do at home or you do in any bar. Taste your drink. When you taste your drink, you're sure, because your lemon juice can have a certain type of pH, your liquor can be sweeter than what you think, or maybe you overput by mistake, even if you were following the recipe, you're always able like to fix it in somehow. Last but not least, we put in our hot cordial in our teapot.
Oh, it smells. This smells like Christmas.
Yeah, really good. I find that cocktail nights always start with the best intentions. One always follows the recipe initially, but after two or three rounds, it does become a bit like, see
but
what happens.
But that's the beauty, you know? Yeah. So you start it with one flavor and then you develop. So maybe the last one will be the best one. I mean, for sure, the last one will be the best one. Well, let's give a little stir and make sure that everything is well balanced, in case we will balance it. Wow, absolutely better than what I did. So here we go. So we have here our mulled wine. Cuddle wine, I will say, as we're gonna be in a family business like family and friends, Christmas, making drinks. And as I was saying as well, it's also versatile drink. So what we have left, we're gonna put in a different cup for our little kids that are around, and we're gonna pour apple juice rather than all the ingredients that we put, like the wine, the gin, and the Camenson. So we're gonna make it non-alcoholic for the kids. And in that case, you can add honey, you can add syrup, you can add maple syrup, whatever they like, just to make them happy, because Christmas Day is just a happy day.
With my kids on Christmas Day, I'll probably give them the alcoholic stuff.
So try, at least try, gonna sleep,
try,
right?
Try and knock them out, yeah, exactly.
Cheers, then.
Oh, cheers. Very rude of
me. Cheers.
Cheers. Oh, that is delicious. Oh, that smells sumptuous.
It's beautifully presented as well. You brought these lovely bits of preserved lemon and a...
Yeah, also...
That's something that's worth bearing in mind, isn't it, when you're at home? It kind of does make it... You eat with your eyes, as they say.
Yeah, exactly.
Slightly savoury, which I guess is the sort of herbs,
yeah,
on the base.
One of the spices is also like a pinch of salt and a pinch of pepper. It will be nice. It will give it a little bit of kick.
This one, it's like a warm embrace, isn't it? I can see why it has the name that it has, and it's even more reassuring being served in a teacup and saucer.
Yeah.
It feels sort of quintessentially English.
Yeah, you know, I believe like on Christmas, what do you want after that you eat all day, you open your gifts and stuff, what you like is just like a lie on the sofa, be with someone, cuddle on the sofa. That's why the name of this drink is cuddle wine, rather than like warm or like mulled wine and stuff like that, you know?
Love it.
Really
it's quite strong.
Probably it's because we overpour some wine. Well, that'll be fine,
whose
you know.
What was that? Whose fault was that?
I don't blame you. Don't worry, that'll be fine.
Shall we move on?
We're gonna go for a boozier drink. Even if the one before, I know they weren't very easy. But anyway, I like boozy drinks, so I'm sorry. What we're gonna do is called like Christmas fashioned. So it's an old-fashioned twist, but it's gonna be like very warm as well, but not as a temperature, obviously, but warm like on flavors. We're gonna have that comfort food, so like chocolate or like sherry, but the syrupy one, so the Pedro Ximénez. And then again, as we don't waste anything, we're going back to reuse one of the ingredients as before. So we're going back to use some Malbec as well. In this case, we will steer this drink, so a different technique. We need again our ice, we need a nice mixing glass, a strainer and spoon, and obviously our jigger to measure more or less what we're gonna put on the mixing glass. We start with 40 ml of whiskey, so in this case for you until the line, for you slightly above. Please feel free to choose the whiskey that you prefer. Obviously, in this case we're using a single malt. Anything, like it could be blended, it could be Japanese
bourbon, or would that be too radical?
Or even bourbon, absolutely. Bourbon has like that nice kick of spice as well, so definitely gonna work. Better is the whiskey, better will your drink it will come. Obviously with like a classic whiskey, like it can be like, I don't know, like blended or like Chivas or like anything else, like even Johnny Walker. Obviously if you do with a premium whiskey, it will be something more. I'm not saying nothing bad, nothing good, but definitely it will be something more.
There might be this idea that you would want to save a premium whiskey just to have it on its own, and that you might not use it in a cocktail. But I feel like you're saying that it's definitely worth considering that. Yeah. It's not a waste.
Exactly. Well, it depends how expensive is your whiskey. So if we're talking about like 25 years old whiskey, well, even on my guess, I'm not suggesting to do any cocktail with that. Like it's like do a Louis XIII espresso martini. If you like it, if you're able to afford it, fair enough. I'm more than happy also to try that. But I will definitely suggest you please have on your own and try it first. And then if you like a cocktail, I'm more than happy to do whatever you like.
I'm kind of talking more like famous Grouse versus Jameson.
Yeah, exactly.
My household.
So in this case, we are going to put 15 ml of Pedro Ximénez. In this case, we have Noël, which is a really, really nice and syrupy sherry. So obviously, Pedro Ximénez is the last step of all the sherries and is very, very dark, very, very deep on flavors, ripe grape. So we're going to put 15 ml. So it's going to be until here at the line.
Stand aside, Org.
15, yeah?
Oh,
there we go, 50.
Yeah, that's perfect. So we save the line. Let's recover our Malbec. So 10 ml of Malbec.
Yeah, go on, please. Thanks, Tom.
He's enjoying.
Watch that elbow, yeah. He looks more comfortable and at home than I've ever seen him in the office. I think it's partly the alcohol, but...
Well, after two drinks, well, it might be, you know. But, you know, also alcohol is relaxing you. So that's why at the end we're doing this, like, deep drink. Just, like, sit down, have a chat with your friends. Then, okay, we put our three ingredients. And last but not least, we have our chocolate bitter. We're going to put 2 dashes of chocolate bitter in each drink as well.
Can I try this on my...
Of course.
Ooh, it's very chocolatey, isn't it? Kind of like a cross between chocolate and medicine.
All the bitters, they have like this side of herbal notes and bitterness, which is coming from roots or from different spices. And then obviously the main flavor, which in this case it will be chocolate, cocoa and all the rest. Well then guys, let's add some ice on your mixing glasses. Go, then you took your spoon and let's stir it down. Let's cool it down a little bit.
You're doing it so quickly. What's the technique? Do you have to hold the stirrer quite loose?
You need to hold the stick in a different way. So if you like the same way how you're writing with a pen, but then you start twisting. Exactly. Well, you learn quite fast. We're actually looking for a barber if you'd like to join our team.
I might drink all the products. This smells perfect already.
Obviously, taste your drink to make sure that it's ready. Is diluted enough.
That's really nice, isn't it?
I told you I don't like weak drinks. So, some ice on your glass.
You would never want to use the ice that you had mixed the drink with to serve it, would you? You want to use new ice for that?
Yeah, I won't use the same ice. I might rather prefer to use the same ice to dilute something else later on, or like use it as a wine bucket or something else, you know? So your ice should be pure because you diluted already. And then as well, when you crush the ice in somehow, could be like stirring, could be like shaking. Obviously your ice is overused, so you'd be more vulnerable to get diluted. Now let's go with our straining to pour over to our eyes.
So this is maybe the only bit of kit that you might not expect to have lying around somewhere, but I'm sure you could find an alternative, can you, to this strainer?
I can tell you, I've been in a couple of supermarkets during those days, just like to figure it out what exactly to do. And I have to say that everywhere now you can find a bartender kit. Bartender kit is mean like a nice strainer, nice mixing glass, a spoon, a jigger, shaker. It doesn't matter if it's plastic or if it's like steel or anything else. You will definitely have your kit, and with like £20 or something like that, you can buy it everywhere. I can say that, like, talking with our guests all the time, everyone say, ah, but when I'm at home, I'm doing my drink with this, I'm doing my martini with this. So people right now that are so into like cocktails, and serving drinks, they have already this kind of equipment at home. Finished with some orange twist, as the smell is always nice. Orange and chocolate, they always work well together. In this case, we can even leave it inside and use it as a stirrer sometimes. And then, well, guys. That's what she said. I'm sorry.
Here we go.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Chocolate and orange, your favourite. He can get through a whole Terry's chocolate orange in one sitting.
Wow, that's beautiful. And there's a real nice dryness to it as well that comes through. That's quite Moorish, which is alarming.
I think that cuddle wine is definitely going to be repeated at mine.
Which one is your favourite then?
I think we may have finished on an absolute high point for me. I think this is just absolutely, that's just beyond delicious. It's sensational.
No, this is great. I might have to sit down for a
So, you know, if people want to come and track you down immediately as a consequence of hearing this, sample the wares, maybe watch you guys in action, where do they go? How do they find out more?
We are at the Scarf Bar at the Rosewood Hotel, which is in Holborn. My name is Eleonora Biason, but obviously any information or if you like to try any of our drinks, our new cocktail menu, which is inspired by music and made with the collaboration of Jarrah Scarf, please feel free to pop in. We'll be more than welcome to advise you to make your drink on your own at home and give you also those recipes like really precisely so you're going to be able to make them at home with your friends on the Christmas day. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed this time and thank you guys.
Our sincerest thanks again to Eleonora Biason, and as you just heard, if you'd like to sample her wares firsthand, do head along to the Rosewood Hotel Scarf Bar in London's Holborn. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
As we've long since established, the spangled pageantry of Christmas may be a nominal service to our Lord and Saviour Jesus, but the festival's roots spiral deep into some seriously dark earth.
We've heard about ghosts, but to help us make sense of the pre-Christian origins of Noel and perhaps redefine the meaning of the magic of Christmas while we're about it, Rob and I turn towards an expert in the esoteric.
Hereward Tilton is an accomplished academic whose research has led him on a path through Rosicrucianism, Christian Kabbalah and alchemy. His forthcoming book explores psychedelic Gnosticism, but he joined us down the line to discuss his work on Touch Me Not, a most rare compendium of the whole magical art. It's a translation of a mysterious 17th century book that looks to the outsider like a collection of magical spells. He started by explaining how he became involved with this terrifying tome.
Well, Robert Ansell at Fulgur Press asked me to help translate and edit the manuscript, which is from 18th century Austria. Its subtitle is A Most Rare Compendium of the Whole Magical Art. And superficially, it does appear to be a grimoire, i.e. a manual of practical magic. But what really stands out about this manuscript are its illustrations. They're vaguely reminiscent of Hieronymus Bosch, but they show us magicians summoning demons in lonely graveyards, as well as the awful things that happen if you make a mistake by stepping outside the protective circle, for instance. We also get to see demonic genitalia, rotting gallows corpses, and so forth, all depicted in loving detail. So the illustrations are quite explicit and historically unusual in that regard.
What were the cultural conditions in which this manuscript existed? Would it have been a dangerous thing to own or write? Were there witch hunters sniffing around looking for this kind of thing?
One of the last executions for witchcraft took place in Switzerland not long before Touch Me Not was composed. That was the case of Anna Guldi. Her execution provoked public outrage. Enlightenment attitudes were fairly widespread by that point. Magical practices tended to be ridiculed as superstition and mental illness, rather than being thought worthy of a death sentence. There was a relatively liberal atmosphere at the time Touch Me Not was written, so I don't think it would have been terribly dangerous to own. You do find rare magical manuscripts advertised for sale in the journals of the time, although this particular manuscript is a little obscene.
And for those uninitiated in the beautiful colour plates in the book, there are a lot of willies. How puerile was it supposed to be, do you think? Are they all serious willies, Hereward?
I think it is a little puerile by today's standards, but its purpose was to shock and titillate, and it probably did. There's also the magical aspect of transgressing the moral code of society. The imagination was thought of as a portal to the supernatural realms. You open the portal by stimulating your imagination in various ways. Touch Me Not includes a tale from the Zohar about Adam spawning demons with Lilith through his masturbation fantasies. That's an example of erotic fantasy opening the portal. And you can look upon the sexually explicit illustrations of the manuscript in a similar light.
Herod, what was the Jena Christmas Eve tragedy? You mentioned that it kind of forms a part of the cultural context of Touch Me Not.
Well, Touch Me Not was conceived in part as a manual for magical treasure hunting. This was a folk magical practice that reached epidemic proportions in the 18th century. The idea was that you would summon the demons that guard buried treasure. One way of invoking a demon is to use psychedelic drugs, and this practice led to a very famous tragedy near the town of Jena. Three treasure hunters met in a remote mountain hut on Christmas Eve, and they brought various grimoires and talismans with them, as well as some charcoal burners and a magical herb known as the Springwurzel. This is a very dangerous hallucinogen from the nightshade family, probably a mandrake root, and legend had it that it could open up the locks of treasure chests. So when the treasure hunters began to summon the treasure guardian, they sprinkled the Springwurzel onto the charcoal burners and lit them up. Unfortunately, it was bitterly cold up in the hills, so they also kept the hut door and windows shut, with dire consequences. The following day, two of the treasure hunters were found stone dead and covered with blue flecks. The third was barely alive, and apparently he was babbling incoherently. To top it all off, two guards were posted to watch over the dead bodies, and they decided to reignite the charcoal burner to keep warm. One of them died, but the other testified that he had seen a demon beating on the cabin door. It was a celebrated case. Theologians debated with enlightened physicians. Was the devil to blame, or was it simply a case of nightshade poisoning?
Hereward, given that this kind of psychedelic magic came from pre-Christian sort of pagan spiritual practices. We know a lot of Christian holy days were cobbled together from previously important dates. Is there anything to infer about how these rituals might have intersected with the calendar, particularly Christmas and times like that?
In the case of the Jena Christmas Eve tragedy, the treasure hunters were summoning an angel of the sun known as Och. The idea was that you would invoke the planetary angel that rules the lower demon guarding the treasure. So choosing the right astrological moment was important. And of course, Christmas is the old pagan festival of the sun's return after the solstice, when the days begin to get longer. Another more general pre-Christian context for magical treasure hunting is the old pagan Germanic notion that dragons guard vast hoards of treasure under the earth. That's an idea that certainly informs this particular folk magical belief.
How much folk magical tradition can be related back to pre-Christian religious practices? What happened to them in translation? You know, when they went from sort of mainstream to underground religious beliefs and practices.
Well, in academia, the idea of pagan survivals in folk belief went out of fashion some time ago, but there are some very clear survivals of pre-Christian beliefs and practices in the learned magic of the Renaissance Magi and the Christian Kabbalists. And that so-called high magic is in fact closely interwoven with what we think of as low folk magic in the early modern period. Learned Christian magic has origins in ancient pagan theurgy. The seven planets and their associated gods were conceived as a kind of ladder or cosmic axis leading to the heavens beyond the eighth sphere of the stars. In the Christian context, the gods were thought of as angels and demons, but the purpose was essentially the same. You ascend the ladder to heaven and become an angel or unite yourself with God. In order to get there, you have to get past those dangerous lower spirits, of course.
Okay, and here's a $64 million question. We've been trying to find this in the book, Hereward. What were the most popular methods for ingesting these psychedelics that people took in order to take them on these journeys?
You find the use of psychedelics in both folk magic and high magic. In popular folk traditions, the best known psychedelic was undoubtedly the witch's flying ointment, which was a salve composed of opium and nightshades, such as mandrake, hemlock, henbane. It was related to the vaginal salves prescribed by medieval doctors. In the case of the flying ointment, you would smear the salve onto a broom handle or a similar object and insert it into your vagina or your anus, as the case may be. Apparently, it imparts a flying sensation, hence the notion of witches flying about on brooms. Early modern trial records suggest there was a thrill-seeking element to this practice. So in that regard, there is at least some similarity with recreational drug use today. A similar combination of opium and nightshades was also used in the incense or fumigations that I mentioned. Although one remarkable fact about Touch Me Not is that it includes a fumigation ingredient which contains dimethyltryptamine, or DMT. That's the main psychoactive ingredient of the Amazonian potion ayahuasca.
I'm interested to know how literal the interpretations they had of their crazy psychedelic trippy visions were. I mean, did people perceive them as genuine paths to other worlds? And if they did, do you think that that's basically as good as them actually just being genuine paths to other worlds?
Certainly, people in the early modern period believed psychedelic substances open up genuine paths to the supernatural realms, just as people still do today. In the case of plant-based psychedelics, or what we call entheogens, it was thought you could get in touch with the spirits or planetary angels associated with that particular plant. Some Christian Kabbalists also use psychoactive forms of the Philosopher's Stone. That's the agent of transmutation created in the alchemical laboratory, which seems to have involved an anesthetic called diethyl ether. The Philosopher's Stone was associated with the blood of Christ and treated as a holy sacrament. It's a little similar in that regard to the shamanic view of entheogens as the flesh of the gods. Some ancient Gnostic Christians also used psychedelics as their sacramental host, and you find a similar approach in ayahuasca churches in South America today.
Are we still in a world where there are practitioners of a sort of unbroken tradition of magic stretching back to pagan times?
Again, with respect to folk magical tradition, the idea of pagan survivals has been widely rejected by the academics. But with respect to high magic, the Rosicrucian traditions are probably the closest you'll get to an unbroken tradition. I'm currently writing a book on psychedelic paths to gnosis or self-knowledge, and there's certainly a remarkable historical continuity with regard to quasi-tantric serpent imagery in the Rosicrucian and related Kabbalistic lineages. You can trace this esoteric symbolism at least as far back as the serpent-worshipping sects among the ancient Gnostics. There's also an even older connection with the serpentine creator deities of Egypt and Mesopotamia.
I know Rob already said that we'd had the $64 million question, but I think I think that was an oversight, personally. Look, Hereward, the real question, can we use Touch Me Not for magic? And if not, where are we looking? What can we use?
Well, if you sincerely believe that demonic entities can lead you to buried treasure, then yes, Touch Me Not is very useful, and good luck to you on your treasure hunt. However, in Rosicrucian manuscripts, we find a symbolic interpretation of magical treasure hunting. The treasure is the divine spark of your own soul. The demonic guardian is the ruler of the planets who has imprisoned that divine spark. From this symbolic perspective, you can also interpret the psychedelic Springwurzel as the key to unlocking your own psyche. I should add, though, that the various psychonautic techniques cultivated in these magical traditions are dangerous. Whether they involve drugs or not, they tend to disintegrate the conscious personality, and they can cause psychosis. So they really must be approached with great caution and respect. If you're looking for guidance, I would get in touch with the various Rosicrucian lineages, or perhaps Santo Daime. That's an esoteric Christian church that uses ayahuasca as a sacrament.
Thanks to Hereward, and Touch Me Not, the most rare compendium of the whole magical art, is the perfect gift for the esotericist in your life, and it's out now, published by Fulgar Press. You, lucky things, are still with the Monocle Weekly.
Well, Rob, I think that was a good, if slightly left field, Christmas show. What do you reckon?
It's good stuff. Hereward was great, and I love being able to get that odd book onto the programme in some way, shape or form. It was a great pleasure for me, and I hope this came through in the interview, to meet Chris Maynard, the straight-laced, but I always thought the sort of demented magus behind that book and that series of books by Osborne. And he's wonderful value, and really interesting also, and a sort of publishing note, to get an idea of how that worked. That must have been a dream job for someone interested in everything in the kind of mid-1970s, to kind of dip their finger into the fast-flowing river of facts, right? And I'm also glad you... I'm obviously contractually obliged not to have cocktails any longer in the studio.
Yeah, you are forbidden from drinking in Midori House.
After the last couple of times when the police were called. And it's just... I mean, yeah, the insurance has gone up a lot on Midori House. So I'm glad that you and Tom Edwards had fun doing that feature.
Yeah, it was very restrained. And thanks to Eleonora again. She put in a lot of care to designing some really delicious Christmas cocktails that I will be debuting back in Cambridge.
Cockmas Christales.
Cockmas Christales is the spoonerism of that.
Okay.
Should we say some goodbyes?
Yeah, let's do it. That was it for edition 546 of The Monocle Weekly.
I produced today's show, and May Lee Evans was our studio manager.
The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week with a special look back at this year's highlights. But for now, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Augustin Macellari.
Thanks for listening.
And happy Christmas.